This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Inshallah, we'll start with the Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya, and then we'll go over Adab al-Mufrad, and maybe we will cancel the Q&A session today, or just do like 10 minutes afterwards. So remember last time we were talking about the difference between, we were still trying to conceptualize that discipline of knowledge, which is Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya, the legal maxims, and we're trying to conceptualize the discipline of knowledge. We're still in the preliminary section. It's interesting section just to, for conceptualization, and then we would go over the qawaid themselves and their applications, and including their modern applications. So we started by talking about how to introduce a subject, and we talked about the definition, we talked about the subject matter, and we started to talk about certain distinctions between this discipline of knowledge and other disciplines of knowledge that are related to it. And we wanted to know the nisbah, which is the relationship between this discipline of knowledge, which is one of the 10 principles of introducing any subject. One of the 10 principles is nisbatuhu wa fadluhu wal wada' al-ismu al-istimdadu hukmu al-shara'. Nisbatuhu, its relationship to other sciences, related sciences. And we began by identifying the relationship between al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya and the mother science, or the father science, fiqh. And we talked about how the relationship is called umum khusus wajhi. It is basically partial overlap or intersection, but it does not. It is still subsidiary, or it is still one of the subordinate sciences, one of the fiqh subordinate sciences. It's subordinate to fiqh. It belongs to the fiqhi sciences. And we started to address some of the distinctions between this science and other fiqhi sciences. And we said that we will need to address the difference between this science and al-qawaid al-usuliyya, the science of usul al-fiqh, the principles of jurisprudence. We need to address the difference between this and what else? Qawaid al-maqasidiyya, the principles of the objectives of Sharia, which is, we said, a separate science, although it does belong to usul al-fiqh to a great extent. And then we will try to figure out the difference between this and al-nadhriyat al-fiqhiyya, the legal theories, the difference between this and al-furuq, the distinctions, the difference between this and al-ashbah wa al-nadha'ir, parallels and analogues, the difference between this and al-madarik, which are the legal bases, and the difference between this and al-dawabit, which are the fiqhi regulators. That's what we will be doing today, to figure out these distinctions. We started last time with the distinction between this and usul al-fiqh, and hopefully we're good with this. So, principles of jurisprudence. And we said, with the principles of jurisprudence, you need the principle before you make fiqh. And then you make fiqh, and then you do your inductive examination of fiqh, and then you come up with the legal maxim, al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya. So this one precedes fiqh, the other one follows fiqh, and we said that they overlap, and we're not going to go back there, but you want to go back and review this, inshallah. And then, so al-qawaid al-maqasidiyya, that is basically principles of the science of objectives. This is the second one that we want to address here. Qawaid al-maqasidiyya, this is two. Okay, so qawaid al-maqasidiyya, principles of maqasid al-fiqh. And we said maqasid al-fiqh as a discipline belongs to أصول الفقه to a great extent, but it has become an independent discipline, and there is no problem in becoming an independent discipline. It is probably a good idea because to understand the objectives of Sharia, to understand the intents of the legislator from legislating, that is important. But as long as we know where it comes from, we do need this when we talk about the ilal of al-ahkam, or the effective causes, or the legal legal rationale of the ahkam. So it belongs to, you know, the chapters of ilal, or the legal rationale of the ahkam. And it is one of the chapters of usul al-fiqh. But then, I just want you to spend some time. I'm spending some time on these issues, basically to not only have a conceptualization of al-qa'ad al-fiqhiyya, which is important, but also to have a conceptualization of legal sciences in general, fiqh and its sciences in general. When it comes to the objectives of Sharia, what are the objectives of Sharia? There are 5 or 6 objectives of Sharia that the scholars talk about. And these are preservation of what? Life? Huh? Does deen come first or life come first? Some people put deen first and some people put life first. But certainly everybody agrees that the life of the hereafter is more important than the life of this world. So deen is more important, but deen prioritizes life. Deen prioritizes life. That is why if you're starving, you can eat pork. You know, the deen does prioritize life. Okay, so deen, you're basically faith, let's say. Life, that would be second. And what would be third? Intellect, because everything is dependent on this after that. Then what would be fourth? Progeny. What would be fifth? Property, wealth, then some people add honor, but which is important. It's an important addition. You know, al-ird, honor, is an important addition. So whether you consider honor to be with progeny, you mix honor and progeny together, or you separate honor from progeny and say that they are six, that's fine. Each one of these has 3 different layers or 3 different grades. So there are certain things that are necessary for the preservation of life. There are certain things that are needed or are considered need. They are important, but they are not necessary. They are not most essential. And there are certain things that are complementary. So we call those darurat, necessities, hajat or hajiyat, that is needs, and then tahsinat or tahsiniyat, which would be embellishments, enhancements, you know, things that are good, you know, but not necessary and not that important, and not that important. If you live in a place where you can't get your groceries unless you have a car, having a car would be a necessity to get your groceries. Having a car that has an AC in the very hot weather, let's say it's like a very hot area, having a car that would have an AC, having a car, maybe that's a good example. That would be a need. Having, a luxury car would be a luxury. Just take that for an example here. So these are the 3 layers: necessities, needs, and luxuries. That is basically the objectives of Sharia. But there are principles that govern, this discipline, because this discipline should not be left without governing principles. Otherwise, everybody would use this. And as we said before, if you just use the objectives of Sharia, if all the tools you have in your toolbox, the objectives of Sharia, and then you can be a faqih in 2 minutes. Bring out this objective, that objective, And then there would not be any difference between Islamic fiqh and any law, even secular law, because, you know, except for the faith, but who would disagree with the preservation of life, disagree with progeny, intellect, property, et cetera, and so on. But Islam provides a roadmap. That's why you have to have principles. And just go back and go over the definition of Sheikh Ibn Ashur, rahimahullah, for general and basically personal, objective Sharia comes to the general public, and it will comes to personal, basically masalih or benefits. Sheikh Muhammad Uthman Shubair, hafidhahullah, had a very good definition for al-qawa'id al-maqasidiyya. This is basically, when we say qawa'id, that means principles. So that means that whatever governs this discipline, qawa'id al-fiqhiyya governs the discipline of fiqh. You know, qawa'id al-usuliyya, the same thing. So qawa'id basically is a principle, a governing principle. So Sheikh Muhammad Uthman Shubair defined al-qawa'id al-maqasidiyya by saying, قضية كلية تعبر عن إرادة الشارع من تشريع الأحكام وتستفاد عن طريق الاستقراء للأحكام الشرعية. So it is قضية كلية, which means a universal principle. كلية means many particulars will apply to it. Something, you know, a universal principle that applies to many particulars. تعبر عن إرادة الشارع expresses the intent of the legislator from legislating, expresses the intent of the legislator. So when we say the preservation of life, when we say وَلَكُمْ فِي الْقِصَاصِ حَيَاتٌ يَا أُولِي الْأَلْبَابِ, it means what? That you will have basically in equal retribution a way to preserve life. This is your way to preserve life, equal retribution. Because if murderers are left unpunished or inadequately punished, then people will be, you know, encouraged to take other people's lives. So this, the intent of the legislator here, the intent from legislating equal retribution here is what? Preservation of life. Okay. So it's قَضِيَّةٌ كُلِّيَّةٌ تُعَبِّرُ عَنْ إِرَادَةِ الشَّارَعِ expresses the intent of the legislator from legislating. وَتُسْتَفَادْ مِنْ. So how do you deduce or how do you extrapolate al-qawa'id al-maqasidiyya from your inductive reading or inductive examination of all the rulings? So it is like al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya in some sense, because it is like al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya in what? In al-istimdad, the source. We're doing inductive reading of the fiqh, and we're identifying that the legislator is always keen on preserving life and legislates to preserve life. Having said that, they overlap, don't they? They overlap. So when you say let's take some of the qawaid al-fiqhiyya, al-umur bimaqasidha, deeds are bought by their intentions. Deeds are judged by their intentions. Let's take darar yuzal, harm should be removed. Are these maqasidi also? Do these point to the objectives of Sharia also and the intent of the legislator? Of course, they do. Their istimdad, their source is the same. You're doing inductive reading of fiqh and you're trying to identify patterns in fiqh. You know, all of the patterns will be, you know, qawaid fiqhiyya, but some of these will be qawaid maqasidiyya. For instance, of the al-qawa'id al-maqasidiyya, النظر في مآلات الأفعال معتبر شرعا, which means considering the outcomes of actions is an acknowledged objective of Sharia. النظر في مآلات الأفعال معتبر شرعا. This is a good example of قاعدة مقاصدية. Which means Muslims should not be looking under their feet only. You should be looking ahead. You should not judge a deed or an action based on the immediate outcome, but the long-term outcome. You will have to think of long-term outcomes when you judge actions or deeds or whatever it is. Another في مآلات الأفعال معتبر شرعا, must be considered, معتبر, considered. You know, and مآلات outcomes, أفعال actions, another basically judging, so on. So this is قاعدة مقاصدية. Can you also call it a قاعدة فقهية? Yes, you can call it قاعدة فقهية because it depends on the point of view, the point of view, the perspective. The maqasidi is looking at this, and the subject matter of maqasid is what? The intents of the legislator, the intents of the God, you know, the lawgiver. So that's the subject matter of maqasid. We're trying to understand the intents of the lawgiver. The subject matter of fiqh is what? أفعال المكلفين, the actions of the accountable individuals. So he's looking at it from this perspective, the maqasidi, the person, the qawaid, al-fiqh discipline is looking at it from a different perspective. They're looking at the same thing from two different perspectives. The faqih will come to this and basically apply it to individual rulings and say, you know, another في مآلات الأفعال معتبر. So I have to be examining, you know, the long-term consequences or outcomes of تحريم or تحليل. Basically declaring this permissible or declaring this impermissible. Impermissible. Okay. You know, this may be, you know, sometimes these are controversial issues, but sometimes you have conflict between al-hasanat wa-siyat. Imam Taymiyyah rahimahullah has a very good chapter on ta'arud al-hasanat wa-siyat, conflict between hasanat and siyat. Like, sometimes, you know, they're having, like, night vigils for Palestine or for the people of Gaza, for instance. Some things that will be done there may not be completely consistent or in conformity with the way we do things or wholesome for us. Should you go? Should you not go? Like encampments, certain things. You will have to look at, this is part of what you look at, you know, outcomes. Now is, you know, you'll have to look at the consequences and the outcomes and the general picture and this conflict between us and that. Like if we don't participate, what does that mean? What is the impact of this on the people in Gaza, short term and long term? What's the impact of it also on the Muslim community, short term and long term? So the faqih is not basically. The fiqh is a little bit more nuanced than many people may think. So this is a qaida maqasidi that has to be considered. But then, you know, does that mean that anyone can use al-qaida maqasidiya and basically make fiqh? No. The very stratification of masalih or benefits and harms, darar, this very stratification does require a great deal of knowledge of fiqh itself. The rulings, al-qa'ad al-fiqhiyya, the legal maxims, the detailed rulings, the sunnah, more importantly, you know, the Quran and the sunnah. So someone who has an extensive understanding, comprehensive understanding of these things will be able to employ al-qawaid al-maqasidiyya or the principles of the objectives properly. So anyway, that is al-qawaid al-maqasidiyya. Legal theories. Okay, this is an E. So let's come to legal theories and the nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya. So what do we mean by You know, some of the scholars said that the Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya are our legal theories. Legal theories, this is a concept that is imported or that is borrowed from the Western legal system. They have the so-called legal theories. It's a theoretical framework for a particular universal concept with broad shared, you know, commonalities or shared commonalities. Such as what, you know, such as al-milkiyya, ownership, such as al-aqd, contract, such as al-daman, liability. This is a concept. This is a huge concept. Al-aqd in Islam, contract. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu awfu bil-uqud, contracts. So when we talk about a legal theory, we're talking about the entire theoretical framework for al-aqd. You know, so Imam Taymiyyah, there is a something called Nadhariyat al-aqd. Certainly, this was a name that was given by later scholars to his writings on contracts. They made a nadhariyat out of it, a theory out of it. He did not say Nadhariyat al-aqd. He did not give that name. They did not, you know, they did not give such names. What I'm trying to say is the fact that they did not give names to these concepts does not mean that the concepts themselves were absent. They just didn't have names. So now we're calling it a legal theory because he talked about aqd, a legal theory. When theory talks about it, it puts a theoretical framework for a concept like al-uqud, like liability, like ship. It is basically the philosophy of the law with regard to contracts, the entire philosophy of law with regard to contracts. It addresses the essence, it addresses the principles, the conditions, the arkan and the shurut, it addresses the exceptions, it addresses basically the divisions, it addresses the consequences of failure in any part of the contract, what are the consequences of not adhering to any of the conditions, any of the arkan, and so on and so forth. So in that sense, can we say that the legal maxims are nadhariyat? Can you say, yaqin la yazul bishak, you know, certainty is not overruled by doubt? Is this a nadhariya? It is a conceptual framework, but it is not what the nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya or legal theories are talking about. Legal theories are talking about coming to one discipline, like contracts, like daman, liability, and basically dissecting, like, you know, addressing the philosophy, the essence, the pillars, the conditions, the divisions, the exceptions, basically consequences of failure. They are somewhat different. In that sense, we can say that al-yaqeen la yazul bishak will be an element in the al-yaqeen la yazul bishak, or, you know, let's say al-ibra fi al-uqud bi al-maqasid wal-ma'ani la bil, you know, al-alfaz wal-mabani. So what matters in contracts are the intents, the meanings and intents, the substance, you know, not the wording and the form, not the forms and words. So that particular principle, this is a qaida fiqhiyya. Is this like a legal theory? No, it belongs under the legal theory of contracts, nadhariyat al-uqud, the legal theory of contracts. Part of it is this qaida. So it's part of the legal theory of contracts. Does that mean that the relationship between them, between al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya and al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya, is that qawaid al-fiqhiyya, al-nadhariyat al-fiqhiyya are always more general and universal, and al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya are, you know, always subordinate or like particulars included in al-nadhariyya? No, it doesn't mean this. Because take, for instance, al-yaqeen la yazul bishak, you know, the certainty is not overruled by doubt. Can you apply this under Nazariyat al-Uqud? Is it part of Nazariyat al-Uqud or the legal theory of contracts? Of course it is part of it. But can you apply it elsewhere? Can you apply it to prayer and purification and, you know, judiciary and penalties? And of course, you can apply. Therefore, it is not just limited to being a part of Nazariyat al-Uqud. So as long as you understand the relationship between them, you will have a good conceptualization of that distinction between the Nazariyat al-Fiqhiyya, legal theories, and al-Qawaid al-Fiqhiyya. Now, the next difference here would be al-Furuq. Al-Furuq are, we call this the distinctions. Distinctions. So you have two similar issues, you know, or matters that to be judged that basically call for a legal ruling. They look similar to each other. One time you give them the same ruling, another time you give them different rulings. When you give them the same ruling, there is probably a legal maxima, qa'ida fiqhiyya, that connects them. That is al-qawa'id. When you give them different rulings, you will have to say why. That is al-furuq, distinctions. So things that may look similar, badi al-ra'i, you know, at first examination, and then they have different rulings. So in this case, we will call the science of Farooq that will point out the differences between, you know, seemingly similar cases or scenarios. Let us take an example from Al-Allama ibn Sunayna al-Hanbali's, Samurai al-Hanbali's book on al-Furuq. And he died in 616. Ibn Qudama died 620. So they were contemporary. Ibn Sunayna was perhaps one of the last great Hanbalis in Iraq. You know, the center, like the, you know, the basically the center of the madhab moved from Iraq, where it started. You know, Imam Ahmad lived in Baghdad, to Al-Sham, you know, around the 6th and 7th centuries. You know, the end of the 6th century, the 7th century, the center of the Hanbali madhab moved from Iraq to Al-Sham. Particularly, you know, there was a great presence in Damascus. That's why you have a lot of Maqdisis. I'm sorry, Jerusalem. That's why you have a lot of Maqdisis in the madhab. But the, you know, they moved because of the Crusades and all of that stuff. The center moved to Damascus. So Al-Allama ibn Sunayna was one of the greatest Hanbalis, one of the last great Hanbalis in Iraq. That doesn't mean, you know, the madhab cannot be revived in one place. Of course, hopefully, inshallah, it will be. So he has this example for us when it comes to Furuq. Okay, so in the madhab, and this is basically, you know, like an application that comes right out of the madhab. So don't look at it as, you know, the ultimate truth. This is the madhabi ruling. In the madhab, you have two different scenarios. One is there is east, west, and south, right? This looks like a cross, I didn't mean, but anyway. So there is east, west, north, and south, four different directions, right? If you are traveling, and you do your ijtihad, and you pray to one direction, is that okay, even if it is wrong? Yeah, it is okay. Do you need to repeat the prayer four times to make sure that you did not miss the prayer? You pray one prayer to this direction, one prayer to that, and one prayer. Do you? No, you don't. Okay. So you have four different garments. Garment should look like this. Four different garments. And one of them, you are sure, had najasa, had filth on it. One of them, you are certain, had filth on it. But then you can't identify which one of them. And four, what do you do? In the madhab, according to the, you know, so even in the madhab, there is difference within the madhab, but we're talking about the authorized view in the madhab. What do you do? Pray five times. Wait a second. No. Pray two times.
All right.
Pray two times. You pray, like, you know, the number of dirty ones, the number of dirty ones, and add one to basically ascertain, to reach certainty that you did make a prayer in a clean garment. So if you think that there were two dirty garments out of the four, how many times you pray? Three. You pray in each garment once to ascertain that you prayed in a clean garment. Three, you pray four, and so on. Okay? So what is the difference between them? That is what ilm al-furuq is about. That is what the science of al-furuq is about. In the science of al-furuq, they will tell you, wajib here, al-wajib here is al-ijtihad itself. To exercise your best judgment is what is obligatory here. What's obligatory here is to pray in a clean garment. What is obligatory here is to pray in a clean garment. What's obligatory here is to exercise best judgment. To the extent that if you don't exercise best judgment, you need to repeat the prayer even if you prayed correctly. And if you exercise best judgment, you don't need to repeat the prayer even if you prayed incorrectly. Because what is required of you here is to exercise best judgment. So that is the science of furuq. Having said that, wait a second. All right, yeah. I just discovered, someone told me last time. So, what? I have to press it again? Okay. Click what? Where is it? This one? Okay. So, having said that, let's move on to the next subject, or the next distinction that we need to make with al-ashbah wal-nadha'ir, which I translated as, and certainly when you translate from Arabic to English, people can disagree on the, you'll find different translations. So al-ashbah wal-nadha'ir, I translated this as parallels and analogues, right? Parallels and analogues. So parallels and analogues, when it comes to so التماثل, which would be similarity, التشابه would be resemblance, and النظائر would be basically analogues. These are three different layers. It depends on the degree of similarity. If they're similar, if the two scenarios or the two cases are similar in every respect, that is tamathul. And then you don't need to talk about them because they're just the same thing. Okay, but then you have certain scenarios where they're more similar than different. So there are a lot of similarities between them, but not in every respect. They would be called al-ashbah, that's resemblances, and we translated it as parallels. Then you have certain cases where there is some similarity in one aspect or two aspects, but there are more dissimilarities than there are similarities. We call those analogues. So it depends on the degree of similarity. At the end of the day, the books on al-ashbah wal-nadha'ir are basically books that are mixing between legal maxims, the qawaid al-fiqhiyya, and furuq, distinctions. You know, ultimately, that will be the majority of what those books are about, and then just read that particular part. And let me give you one, Ashbah will be like Al-Qawa'd Al-Fiqhiyya, because the similarities will include the ruling as well. So when it comes to Al-Ashbah, where you have more similarities than dissimilarities, one of the similarities is the ruling itself. So it would be just like Al-Qawa'd Al-Fiqhiyya in this case. But let us get some nadha'ir, which will look more like Al-Furuq, like distinctions. Let's take one example. You know, Al-Nadha'ir by Imam Suyuti, rahimahullah ta'ala. So in Al-Ashbah al-Nadha'ir by Imam Suyuti, he said, building on the action of another person to basically pass the torch to another person and to build an action on another person. Isn't it true that when the Imam is praying, he can have someone replace him? Substitution, it's called substitution or istikhlaf in prayer, like Umar radiallahu anhu did with Abdurrahman ibn Auf. So to have someone finish the prayer off. So he built on the action of someone else. Okay. So Suyuti rahimahullah says, can you do this with adhan? Can you do part of the adhan and have someone finish it off? He said, you know, the stronger position, all of these are controversial. The stronger position, no, you cannot. Can you do this with khutbah? He said, based on the fact that you can do it in salah, yes, you can do it in khutbah. So the khatib basically, you know, gets tired or something happens to the khatib. Can someone build on it? Yes, istikhlaf, substitution in khutbah would be accepted, he said. Can you do it in salah? He said, yes, you can do it in salah. You know, when you have like an imam take over, can you do it in Hajj? Said no, you know. So this is basically the same thing. Build, you know, it's not the same thing, actually. You know, they're not the same thing. But he's telling you this may appear to be the same thing. It is basically substitution. It is basically building on the action of another person. However, you have different rulings here because these things are dissimilar more than they are similar. So that is basically Al-Ashbah al-Nadha'ir, because there are certain books that, you know, the books of Qawa'id, like Suyuti's, Ibn al-Nujaym's, they're called Al-Ashbah al-Nadha'ir. Why are they called Al-Ashbah al-Nadha'ir? Probably to also include those cases where there are dissimilarities. Similarities. Okay. Then, okay. So number six would be what? Would be al-madarik. Al-madarik. Al-madarik basically would be the legal basis. Al-mudrak and call al-madrak, but the people of will wish to correct the fuqaha and say it's called, it's al-mudrak, not al-madrak. But so al-madarik, which is the plural of mudrak, means legal basis, legal basis. So when you say that an intention is required in wudu, when we say an intention is required in wudu, you know, the Hanafis may not say the same thing. Or like when Hanbalis say intention is required in wudu, and the Hanafis say, why are you saying this? Then or ghusl, or the, you know, so why are you saying this? We will say what? Al-umur bimaqasidha. Deeds are judged by their intentions. You know, deeds are hinge on their intentions, contingent on their intentions, and so on. So that is part of a discussion. So when we are saying this, are we mentioning qa'ad al-fiqhiyya basically just as a qa'ad al-fiqhiyya, a regulator of different, a universal rule that applies to many particulars, or are we using it to point out the legal basis for our position in the madhab? We're using it to point out the legal basis for our position in the madhab. When we say al-umur bi maqasidha, to indicate that niyyah is needed for the acts of purification like wudu and ghusl. So we're using this to say, no, this is the legal basis. Al-mudrak is the legal basis. Al-qa'ada al-fiqhiyya, or the legal maxim, most of the time would include the mudrak. Most of the time will include the mudrak. And if it doesn't explicitly include it, it hints to it. It hints to it. And but that is that all, always the case? No, it's not always the case. Because al-qa'ada al-fiqhiyya are regulators. So they are patterns that we have detected by inductive examination of fiqh. We have detected this pattern. Does the pattern always have to point to the legal basis? No. It just points to a pattern, not necessarily a legal basis. The legal basis could be different, but this. Let me give you an example. مَا جَازَ بَيْعُهُ جَازَ رَهْنُ مَا جَازَ بَيْعُهُ جَازَ رَهْنُ. Anything that's permissible to sell is permissible to mortgage. Anything that's sell is permissible to mortgage. Is the fact that it is permissible to sell the legal basis for the permissibility of mortgage in it? No, it's not the legal basis. Although it may hint to it in some way. How does it hint to it? Because they share, like anything that can be sold has manfa'a mubaha, permissible benefit. So you could fulfill, you know, your right as a creditor. Like when you have something mortgaged, you're basically saying to the creditor, if I don't pay you, you have this. You know, you could fulfill your right from this item, from this property. You can sell it and basically, or you could use it because it has a manfa'a mubaha. It has a permissible benefit. So it's pointing, it's hinting at the legal basis, but it is not the legal basis in and of itself. But you could use another example that will highlight this a little bit more. When they say in sujood al-sahw, in the Hanbali madhab, for instance, they say in sujood al-sahw, when are you required to make sujood al-sahw? You know, prostration of forgetfulness? If you do something or omit something that will invalidate the prayer, if you do it intentionally. مَا يُبْتَلْ عَمْدُهُ. So if you do it intentionally, it will invalidate your prayer. Okay, to add one ruku'ah, to omit ruku'ah, to add one sujood. If you do this intentionally in the prayer, your prayer is invalid. To turn, to take one step, to do things of that nature. If you do it intentionally, it does not invalidate your prayer, does not require a prostration or forgetfulness. Is that clear? It is clear. Okay. Yes. No, it's not the legal basis. You know, the legal basis is when you say al-umur bi-maqasidha, when you say, you know, the niyyah is a condition. Niyyah is a condition because al-umur bi-maqasidha. That is the qa'idah, and at the same time is the legal basis. Qa'idah is al-umur bi-maqasidha. The legal basis is al-umur bi-maqasidha. Al-umur bi-maqasidha is another formulation of a'malu bi-niyyat. Hadith of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. I will use the same example of the prostration of forgetfulness in making the distinction between al-qa'ida and al-dabit, al-qa'ida al-fiqhiyya and al-dabit, which is the last one in the distinctions we will address. This will be the last one. Number seven. Al-dawabit, which is the plural of al-dawabit, which we will translate as regulators. Regulators. It is simple, so let's not waste too much time on this, because this should be simple. The difference between al-qa'ida al-fiqhiyya and al-dawabit is that al-qa'ida al-fiqhiyya is bigger, more universal, and has more applies to more particulars. It crosses the lines between the different chapters. So when you say yaqeen la yazul bishak, you know, which is certainty is not overruled by doubt, does it cross the line between ibadat, worship, muamalat, transactions, qada and hudud and jinayat, judiciary? Crosses all the lines. That's a qaida fiqhiyya. That's a huge qaida fiqhiyya. That's why we call it a grand, kubra, qaida fiqhiyya. But there are qawaid fiqhiyya that have a little bit more limited applications. We call them qaida fiqhiyya, but we don't call them kubra, you know, ghayr al kubra. But then when you have, they, you know, earlier, they did not even make a distinction between al-qawaid al-fiqhiyya and al-dawabit, because they're the same thing. But then as sciences develop, terms become more specific and the things become more nuanced and more refined and so on and so forth. So al-Mardawi, rahimahullah, himself, was talking about the difference between qawaid al-fiqhiyya and dawabit, and he said, basically, if it is one chapter, if it applies in one chapter, it's dawabit. If it applies in several chapters, it's qaida. And he gave an example to something that applies to one chapter. Which example did he give? He said, kullu kafaratin sababuha al-ma'asiyya fahiyya ala al-fawr. Every expiation that is caused by a sin is immediate. You have to expiate immediately. If the expiation is caused a sin, you have to expiate immediately. If you are expiating because you did not fast in Ramadan because you were sick or something, you know, the expiation is not necessarily immediate. But if you expiate because you have committed a sin, the expiation must be immediate. Is this a dhabit really only? Some people, there is always disagreement over these issues because it depends on how you're looking at it. If you consider al-kaffarat, expiations, a chapter, or, you know, like a specific chapter, then you will say it's a dhabit because it applies only to kaffarat. But there are kaffarat in different abwab, in different chapters. So if you consider the fact that kaffarat belong to different chapters in fiqh, you will say, no, it's a qaida. Yeah, so it depends. But there are certain things that are a little bit clearer, that are easier to grasp, such as this prostration of forgetfulness. Is it a qaida or dhabit? That's a dhabit. You know, that basically, you know, something very specific and very limited in its scope of application. Even more than this, which may not be a dhabit to begin with, is when in the Hanbali madhab, when is your ruku' valid? Your ruku' valid if you're close to standing. So someone is doing this. Is the ruku' valid? No, it's not in the madhab. Someone who does this, is the ruku' valid? Yes, because it's closer to this proper ruku' than it is closer than qiyam. Okay? So is this a dhabit? Because a dhabit is a regulator. It's a universal principle that applies to different particulars. Does this apply to different particulars, or it regulates that specific ruling? No, it regulates for the faqih that very specific ruling. So it's a dhabit in the linguistic sense. And this dhabit in and of itself belongs to a qaida, lil-akthar hukm al-kull, lil-akthar kull al-hukm, which means that the majority assumes the ruling of the whole, or the majority assumes the ruling of the whole. ما قارب الشيء يعطى حكمه. So what approximates something is basically assumes its ruling. Anyway, so that's the difference between al-qaida and al-dhabit. It's about the scope of application. He taught me this. Oh, wait a second. Oh, it works. So these are the seven different distinctions that we need to make to understand and to have a good conceptualization of legal maxims. And, you know, sometimes we're talking about difference in the subject matter, such as when it comes to the principles of jurisprudence, the subject matter of this is what? The adilla, the evidences of Sharia. Examines the adilla of Sharia, and it examines how to use these adilla of Sharia, the evidence of Sharia, to deduce ahkam from them. The subject matter in this is intents of the legislator, or the lawgiver, legal theories. The subject matter of this is ahkam al-mukallafin, the ahkam al-mukallafin, which is the actions of the accountable individuals. Isn't it the subject matter of a qa'ad al-fiqhiyya? Yes, it is the same subject matter. So what's the difference between them? We talked about it. So the difference between them is that qawa'id are part of al-nazariyat, but the qawa'id have also more applications, and the scope of operation is wider than a particular nazariyat. Al-furuq al-fiqhiyya, this is a fiqhi science. The subject matter of it is like fiqh. This is basically the mirror image of al-qawa'id. Al-qawa'id, I'm showing you why they're given the same ruling. Al-furuq, I'm showing you why they're given different rulings. And al-ashbah al-nadha'ir basically is a mixture between al-qawa'id and al-furuq to a great extent. Al-madarik would be the legal basis. The subject matter of this is what? It's still fiqh. It's still a fiqh science. So the subject matter in this case would be the rulings. The rulings, and to basically al-ahkam, the rulings, and to identify their legal basis. And at the abit, it's the same subject matter, but it's only a difference in scope. Only a difference in scope and the number of applications. And with this, we would have come to the end of today's class on al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. Inshallah, the next session will be on the divisions of al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya. And maybe we will be able to cover more than just the divisions of al-qawa'id al-fiqhiyya, and we will start to address the emergence of this discipline and its development over the generations.